What's up, everybody? Welcome back in to another episode of the Lawyer You Know podcast. And today we're going to be breaking down more documents that have been filed near the time of trial in the Karen Reed case, and especially about the ARCA experts, because there's some really interesting nuance to what's going on with the fact that ARCA is no longer under contract with the feds. And how does that change whether or not Karen Reed can use them and say they were hired by an unbiased third party in this case? And whenever we have something dealing with the feds, I like to bring in the secret weapon that no other channel but mine has, and that's my dad, former assistant United States attorney, chief of the criminal division in the Middle District of Florida. He's going to come on and talk about what it's like when the feds have experts, when they don't, what they have to share and what they don't, because we know Hank Brennan wants more discovery about these experts, and guess what? The feds don't always turn it over. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about impeachment evidence. A criminal defense attorney, Alan Jackson, does not want to turn over all the impeachment evidence because he says it helps out the Commonwealth's witnesses too much. And whether or not that's something we've ever asked for, my dad and I are going to talk about it, whether or not we think it's fair, whether or not we think that's changed because of trials being live streamed. Now, everything is changing in the world of trial law because of these live streams. We're going to get into all that and more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Welcome in, Dad. We are going to jump right into the first document, which is the ARCA experts, right? Just for anybody that is new to this case and this trial, good luck catching up. But my dad has seen snippets of it, followed it a little bit, not followed it as religiously as we all have. We had him in early to talk about the federal investigation. We did an entire video on that because he did things like that at the U.S. Attorney's Office when he was there. He's also now been a criminal defense lawyer for the past, 40 years. That's what our firm does, is criminal defense and personal injury. So when we talk about it from a criminal defense attorney's mindset, that's where we've been in my whole career, basically, besides early on when I prosecuted cases. My dad's most of his career as criminal defense attorneys, but also with an eye towards what the prosecutors think. And in this case, the feds investigated the investigation of what is going on with Karen Reed. We don't know a whole lot about it. We don't know what the outcome is. But they had a couple experts that they hired from ARCA, which is an engineering firm. Basically, they are experts. They are hired to do accident reconstruction work, biomechanical engineers, things like that, that you would hire in a civil case. Like if we have a trucking accident case, they can reconstruct the entire accident, or in certain criminal cases involving cars, like this case, which is involving a car. And in the first trial, Karen Reed's team presented these ARCA experts as independent, unbiased witnesses that were hired by a third party. I can't remember, agency, I think is what they said. A lot of people thought it was Karen Reed's, insurance potentially that paid for it, or it was some supporter of Karen Reed that paid for these experts. Basically, most of the comments that are leaking out from the jury, we haven't heard from the jury's mouth, is they didn't understand that this was hired by the FBI or the feds or the U.S. Attorney's Office. And that was by design, right? That's, the judge does not want everybody to know they were hired by the feds. That could have some inference that maybe is improper in this situation. Some people think that's exactly how it should be. Regardless, they were able to present these experts without really having to pose them, saying they never really talked to them before, and the judge let it in. Well, trial two is coming up, and those experts were potentially the most important and best witnesses for Karen Reed to show, and they opined that looking at John O'Keefe, looking at this whole situation, looking at the Lexus, reconstructing everything with all the numbers they have, it does not seem like there was a car accident here, that he was hit by a car. It does not seem like that's what happened. Some of the most important evidence ends up in a hung jury. Karen Reed mentioned it in a recent interview that she thinks that's the most important evidence for her as well. And now the Commonwealth is trying to block those witnesses. They have tried to block a couple other expert witnesses, saying that the expert witnesses like Dr. Russell either are not qualified or their methodology is not proper. It does not clear the Daubert standard. So far, the judge has not struck any of their experts. So some people assumed when they were going to try to strike these ARCA experts that it was going to be under the same theory, but it's not. Instead, it's a Rule 14 issue, and they're saying that these are discovery violations by the defense. And therefore, because of these discovery violations, these witnesses should be struck altogether and should not be allowed to testify. Anything you want to comment on, Dad, before we get to the actual motion?
No, because everything's going to come out when we discuss exactly. The motion.
All right, so let's get to it and then jump in whenever you want. This is the Commonwealth's motion to exclude employees of ARCA LLC. The Commonwealth moves to exclude the defendant from calling employees of ARCA LLC, including but not limited to Daniel Wolf, PhD, and Andrew Rentschler, PhD, due to the defendant's failure and inability to comply with discovery obligations under Massachusetts Rule of Criminal Procedure 14. So what's interesting right off the top is failure and inability. That inability can have two meanings, right? He could be saying that sarcastically, like they just can't seem to deal with the rules, or inability could be very legitimate because when you're dealing with the feds, sometimes you're not able to get certain documents or things over to the other side, as the prosecution in most cases knows.
And you emphasized earlier, and I think that the listeners need to know that that's important, that this motion does not go to Daubert, that this motion does not go to the quality or the qualifications, really, of these experts. It goes to the fact that this is a discovery violation. And that's really an important distinction, because normally we'd see these kind of motions as challenging it as a Daubert situation, but they're limiting themselves to strictly a discovery violation.
Yeah, and when I first heard leaks that they were going to try to strike these experts, I was like, good luck on Daubert, because they are prototypical witnesses. They're professional witnesses. Like, you'd never be able to strike them.
These are biomechanical engineers, like the top tier.
Exactly.
Just
showing again how the federal government has unlimited resources when they try to prosecute these cases against criminal defendants. As revealed during the defendant's first trial, Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler were two experts retained by the federal government in furtherance of the U.S. attorney's investigation of an unspecified federal crime. Again, remember, the Commonwealth is writing this motion. They agree that they were hired by the federal government, but they say, we don't really know what they were investigating. It seems to be into the investigation of Karen Reed and prosecution of Karen Reed, but we don't really know.
Well, again, an admission in this motion that there is a federal crime being investigated. I don't think we've seen it in the past where they've admitted that there's a federal crime being investigated.
Both Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler admittedly did not review all pertinent and relevant evidence that exists in this case, asserted that they did not speak with the defense prior to their testimonies, and conducted experimentation and analysis that exceeded the facts and evidence in this case. Nonetheless, the court permitted both Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler to testify on behalf of the defendant in June of 2024.
Okay.
So now, go ahead. You go first.
Go ahead. No. All right. Important facts to take a look at. First, they did not interview the witnesses before they put them on the stand. This is so significant. It's my understanding that there was a federal protective order that they could not talk to these people about what they did with the federal government. And so they couldn't interview them before they put them on the stand. It's also interesting that they're willing to put them on the stand cold, without interviewing them and without prepping them before they testified. And that there is no requirement that an expert review all pertinent and relevant evidence. They only need to review enough so that they have a basis for their opinion. So, there's some blusterings, they're saying things in here. When you look behind them, they really are a waste of breath when they go through this.
So, and that's really, I don't know, for some reason, I have a memory that they could have interviewed them at some point or talked to them at some point, and they chose not to because they didn't want it. There was a protective order over certain documents and certain conversations, but I thought they could talk to them about what their testimony is going to be. I don't remember. You could be right about that. But you pointed out a very good point, which when I was reading this, I was like, that doesn't matter. You know what that is? That's fodder for cross-examination. The fact that they didn't look at all the evidence, guess what? You say, you didn't even look at all the evidence, and you say that to the jury in your argument. But that's not something that strikes witnesses. And they admit that, basically, when they mention those two problems, they didn't look at everything in the case. They went outside the scope and facts of evidence in this case. They didn't talk to defense counsel, and they were still allowed to testify in the first trial. So the judge already knew about all those things. It's the same judge, and now he's throwing those out there again, but those are not going to be reasons they're going to get struck, which is why there's more to this motion. That's not where it ends. The parameters of the expert's opinion were not provided by the defendant prior to her first trial, and portions of the expert opinions were not expected nor properly noticed. Furthermore, during the first trial, Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler testified to reviewing information that was not known to rendering their opinions, and this was not previously disclosed to the Commonwealth. So what I wanted to point out here is this is a situation where this is where it's going to get interesting. And we're going to start getting into points. And I want to get your thoughts on, you have an expert. There are mandatory disclosures that you have to tell the other side what your expert is going to testify to, what they're basing their expert testimony on. That's a normal rule in civil and criminal procedure. You have to do that. Unless the feds won't give you that information and you can't turn over that information. So that's what makes this so different than any other expert that an individual would hire on their own.
Well, you know, this is a unique situation. This trial is a unique situation. I mean, so many things happen in this trial. How many times do you say that this is a unique situation when you're talking about this trial? And this is a unique situation. I mean, I've never heard of a situation where feds hire experts, they release the experts, and defense attorneys put the experts on the stand cold to testify. I've never heard of that. Now, I've got to admit, and I got to give him credit, the defense lawyer in this case was a prosecutor at one time before. And prosecutors get handed files all the time because of the volume of trials. Say, hey, go down and try this case this morning. So they hand you a file. You go down and try a case cold. You've never interviewed the witnesses. You haven't prepped anybody for the trial. But you walk in there and you try the case cold. You know how to do it, so you do it. This didn't bother Jackson at all. He's probably done it 100 times before this. So he puts him on cold and figures he's got nothing to lose.
So that was one of my favorite things to do at the prosecutor's office when I first started, because and when I went, you were like, here's your point. Just get as many trials as you can. That was basically the advice when I went in there. So in my experience, I didn't get up to major crimes like Jackson and running the entire office, basically, or like you did at the U.S. Attorney's office. I was just a young prosecutor there. And so when this would happen to me and they would hand me a file when I would show up the day, sometimes doing two trials in one day, one in the morning and one in the afternoon, they're like simple misdemeanors, but I didn't care because it was no pressure. Nobody wanted to try the case. That's why I was trying it at that point, being so young anyways. And so there was no pressure. So if you go win, everybody's like, wow, and celebrating. If you lose, they're like, yeah, that's why nobody wanted to try the case. And that's really what would happen a lot, but not as a criminal defense attorney. That's not normal for us. But I think that Jackson knew, obviously, what the parameters of their testimony were going to be. The Commonwealth did too, but not the details. Both attorneys had to react to the details at the time during trial. That's what trial lawyers do. So it just is what it is. And Hank Brennan's like, we weren't sure about some of the things that were going to happen. It's like, yeah, neither was the defense. And you have to react to it sometimes.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Prior to and during the defendant's first trial, the Commonwealth repeatedly moved for reciprocal discovery from the defendant, citing a restraint and inability to comply with Massachusetts Rule of Criminal Procedure 14. The defendant failed to provide the Commonwealth with any discovery from the ARCA, LLC, Dr. Wolf, or Dr. Rentschler. So again, this already happened before the first trial. This judge already let them go forward, even though Rule 14 was not complied with because of the very different and specific scenario we're dealing with here. To allow the defendant ample time to retain her own experts and to prevent any delays in the April 1st, 2025 trial date, on December 5th, 2024, the Commonwealth renewed its request for discovery, enumerating 13 areas of discoverable materials related to ARCA LLC from the defendant. So if you notice there, they hope, they wish, they pray they would get different experts than these guys.
And that's what they're trying to force them to do it. That's the whole idea, because if they can't comply with discovery for these experts, judge, then make them hire other experts so that they can comply with discovery. That's their point, is to force them to get their own experts, which, we're going to see is really doesn't make sense when you go through this, because this judge did fashion a remedy that I think was appropriate.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that, but, one of the most important things about getting their own expert would then be, you hired this expert, you paid this expert, they're your hired gun, versus right now they can say, We didn't even hire you. We didn't pay you. An independent third-party agency did. And if a juror picks up on that, that's a very big deal because everybody else is like, you're their witness. You're their witness. Like, well, this is nobody's witness and look at what they're testifying to. Now, I make a big deal of that because I understand how all that works in the background. Does the jury? I don't know. Let's see, where were we? On January 6, 2025, the Commonwealth notified the court and the defendant of its intention to move to exclude ARCA and Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler based on the defendant's repeated failure and inability to comply with Rule 14. To date, the defendant has filed no response nor produced any additional discovery. On February 6, Attorney Jackson indicated to the Commonwealth that and this court that he intends to call the ARCA experts, presumably Dr. Wolf and Dr. Rentschler, at the defendant's upcoming trial. Duh. On December 4th, the Commonwealth filed a written request for discoverable material from the U.S. Attorney's Office pursuant to 28 CFR 1621, which is a TUI request. On January 30th, the Commonwealth and defense received a response from the U.S. Attorney's Office citing certain federal statutes and regulations that restrict the complete discovery the Commonwealth is entitled to. So why don't you explain why the U.S. government can restrict what he says the Commonwealth is entitled to? So it's like they're asking the defense, they ask the U.S. Attorney's Office, they say, this is all we're going to give you. Why is that a thing?
Well, there's a couple ways that, or a couple statutes or rules that prevent it. Number one, if this was grand jury material and it was presented to the grand jury, Rule 6 is what it's called, that they cannot disclose because what happens in a grand jury is secret. So number one, they can't disclose that. If it's material that they have pursuant to criminal investigations, it's an active investigation. So they don't have to disclose that. And thirdly, we're the federal government and we don't have to disclose anything that we don't want to disclose. And you can't make us disclose, which is true. You can't make us disclose anything. So, you know, tough luck.
And that's really what it comes down to is they get to do what they want to do. And right. There's not really anything anybody can do, including the Commonwealth, right? Defense attorneys, we're put in this position all the time and everybody's like, tough luck. But when it's the prosecutors that are put in this position, the rules apply to them similarly.
Right. And, you know, and federal judge, I remember Judge Krentzman used to tell me this all the time. A state court judge can't get you out of federal prison, but a federal judge can get you out of state prison, which means that you listen to the federal judge. And that state judge can't do anything about it. And that state judge knows he can't do anything about it. So he just has to live with it. And he knows the defense lawyers can't do anything about it or the prosecutors. So they got to live with it.
Frankly, even sometimes the judges. Like, we've had trials where the judge has to send us out of the courtroom and our client and everybody else because the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office have to tell them something. And we're like, what? And we've mentioned this before, but we just want to illustrate the power and how it's like, oh yeah, we have all these rules that keep everything fair. It's like, well, sometimes the federal government can break the rules and there's just a rule that says they can. And it's sometimes this is what it looks like.
Right.
Peculiarly, despite the formal 4-page letter received on January 30th, 25, following the party's appearance before this court on February 6th, the Commonwealth and defense received an email from the U.S. Attorney's Office stating that their contract with ARCA ended on July 31st, 2024, and should either party wish to engage ARCA for additional analysis, any further engagements must not infringe on any federal privilege. So what he's saying is this is weird because the government said, well, here's all we're going to give you, but they didn't tell us before in the 4-page letter that their contract with ARCA is up. Now they're telling us their contract with ARCA is up, and if either of you guys want to engage ARCA, go ahead, but you still can't infringe on any federal privileges. Why don't you explain what that means?
Well, it means you can't ask ARCA anything about what happened in the grand jury, any of their presentations, and I'm sure that in ARCA's contract with the federal government, there was some kind of a confidentiality privilege stated in that contract that they couldn't reveal their discussions because it was an active criminal investigation. And they became agents of the government when they were doing their work for the government, which again goes back to the point why they could not interview the ARCA people about what they did with the federal government or their testimony in the grand jury, because that would violate the federal privileges.
So basically, it means it's not going to change any of the information that's going to become available for the defense or the prosecutor. Just because the contract is up does not mean you're going to get more now than you would have gotten before. That's number one. But the second and almost more important point to me is if they're going to testify at trial two, does that mean Karen Reed and her team are going to have to pay their expert fee to show up to trial to testify. Because if they are, then that's going to change the whole, we haven't paid you anything, nobody on our team engaged you, this, you're an independent third party. So if their contract is up with the federal government and they come to testify, I'm interested to see how that goes. I was also interested under the first trial. We never really found out, at least nobody told me. They show up and they testify for the defense. Did the federal government pay them to do that? Because if I'm the federal government, I may say that's outside the scope of what we hired you for. That's not under the contract, yep, testifying in other trials. But they did that. What is your thought on that?
I don't think the federal government paid them. It's possible the defense lawyers did pay them.
I don't think so. Based on what they said at the trial, that would be a false affirmation and a false statement if they paid them to come testify.
Well, no. The point is, I don't know if the prosecution wanted to get into it, because if they got into it, they're going to say all this work was done pursuant to the FBI requirements, because they didn't do any work for the defense lawyers.
I agree, but it would still be, you paid me $5,000 to testify today. That's absolutely a fair question from the Commonwealth with how the defense set it up, that we've done nothing. We've never spoken to you. We've never paid you. You're not our hired witness. And if you did pay them to sit up there and testify, that's fair game. And they were never going to get into the federal investigation. This judge was protecting them from that 100% of the time throughout this trial. So I was interested in how that happened. I don't know. I would think they did not pay them. If they did pay them, that would feel a little bit weird. But now I think that might have to change because they're not under contract with the federal government.
Well, I don't know. You know, again, from the way I understand the cross went, I'm sure the prosecution would have gotten into it if they had paid them. But it would shock me if these guys who make their living testifying, it would shock me if these guys did not get compensated for testifying in the state trial, but it would also shock me if the feds paid them to testify in a state trial. So these guys might have done it out of the goodness of their heart at some point, because maybe they made enough money from the federal government that they went ahead and threw in this testimony and just did it out of the goodness of their heart.
Yeah, I just don't know. And that's another thing that makes this so interesting and so different about this case, because it's just not the normal process and procedure of how all this works. I would be shocked also if they testified for free the first time, but I wouldn't be as shocked if they testified for free the second time. Number one, because of how the Commonwealth's kind of acting towards them. Number one. Number two, they've kind of gotten some minor internet fame as, you know, these crash daddies or whatever people are calling them. And everybody loved them, thought they were so great and handsome and smart, and everybody loves them. So maybe they want to go round two. And maybe they want to do it for free so that they can still say the defense has never paid us, which they are allowed to do. Say the defense has never paid us. The defense has never given us any money or anything to be here and testify.
Maybe I missed it when I was reading this. But you know what? It would have been a logical request by the Commonwealth is for any receipts or any evidence of any payments to these people by the defense lawyers. And I didn't see any specific requests for that.
Well, I mean, they asked for everything that has to do with these in the 13 different discoverable areas.
Right.
But I think right now, everybody
said there's none. They said there's none.
And that's my point, is I think everybody's under the impression right now that they have not paid them a dollar. That's what I think is going on with these experts at this point. But I also am interested to see, will that change now that they are not under contract with the federal government? Will the judge now force the defense to reach out to these experts, get their opinion, get their methodology, disclose it as an expert appropriately to the Commonwealth, like we have to do with every expert in every case? Do you think the judge reverses course and says, now that they're not under contract, you have to go get this information? Or does the defense still have a good argument that says, judge, everything that was privileged is still privileged. They have everything we have. They testified in the first trial. There's no fundamental fairness issue. There's no prejudice. They have their testimony. It's going to be the same as it was in the first trial. They got to voir dire these witnesses in the first trial. How in the world is this prejudicing the Commonwealth?
Absolutely. And not just that, you talk about their test. They've got their testimony twice. Right. You know, they've got the voir dire once. They've got the trial testimony twice. So they've got everything. They've got all the basis, because, you know, I'm sure in the cross-examination, they cross-examine them on the basis for their opinions. What did they base it on? What did they look at? What did they see? How did they analyze it? They also probably got into their resumes and they got into, you know, why they're experts, because apparently, again, looking at this motion, they're not challenging the expertise of these two guys. It's they got into it, and you know, I hate to say this, but in reading this motion, it almost sounds like a crybaby and a waste of time, because I would love to have
the people listening to this are going to love that you said I'm sure.
I would love to have a situation where, all right, I have defense experts. Fine. I get to voir dire defense experts. I get to cross-examine them. I get to put them on the stand. I've got two prior testimonies of the defense experts. You never have that anyway when you're going to trial on an expert. So they've got so much on these guys already that they're just doing this just to cry wolf, because the judge has a right to fashion a remedy. And you mentioned the voir dire. He could have kicked these experts out, saying that, you know, you didn't give the proper disclosure, the proper discovery. But he didn't in the first trial. He said voir dire was the way to do it. And he allowed the voir dire, and he allowed them to testify. I just don't see how this...
Yeah.
Excuse me?
It's a female judge. She.
Right. But she's not been a friend of the defense in this case. So the fact that I can't see her changing her mind.
No, I agree. And I think it's funny, you know, but after all that, he still doesn't like what they have to say. So he's trying to find a way to get rid of them, because I think they're the most important and best piece of evidence for the defense, which again, if the judge is going to strike these witnesses, it's going to be appealed like that. You are removing the defendant's defense in a murder trial. But you just can't do that as a judge. And this guy knows that. There's no secrets. It's not like they're withholding information or expert testimony. They know what it's going to be. That's the whole point. What's the prejudice? There is none. All right, let's read the last page here. Rule 14 demands reciprocal and expert discovery. As the proponent of the evidence, the defendant bears the full obligations of Rule 14. The defendant cannot shield herself from discovery obligations by citing restraints by the U.S. Attorney's Office or by now perhaps claiming to have independently retained ARCA for additional analysis and producing only a limited portion of expert discovery. So maybe the defense has retained them now. I don't know. The Commonwealth remains unduly prejudiced by the defendant's delays in providing appropriate discovery and notice to the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth has diligently sought expert discovery from the defendant and the United States Attorney's Office for approximately 10 months. A second voir dire is not an appropriate remedy, as the defendant has continued to sidestep their discovery obligations. So it's like, judge, even if you're going to offer this fair remedy, we don't want it. Because they know they're not going to learn anything new from it. They already know everything. So a second voir dire is not going to help them. The Commonwealth is entitled to a fair trial and simply has sought what every criminal defendant in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is obligated to produce. The Commonwealth is entitled not to repeatedly be ambushed at trial and be permitted to effectively prepare for cross-examination of any witness. And that would be the prejudice. If they weren't able to do that, then the judge should strike these witnesses. But they are able to do that. Strategic decisions do not alleviate a defendant from discovery compliance after 10 months. The only remedy is exclusion. A criminal defendant's constitutional right to call a witness on her behalf is not absolute and may be limited in the judge's discretion in the face of legitimate demands of the adversarial system. I can almost guarantee, I did not read that case, I can almost guarantee it is something so much worse than what is happening here if they really struck an expert witness from a defense.
Well, you know, and the word ambush is kind of hypocritical in this particular case, because I mean, from what I've read, the Commonwealth's been pretty ambushy during the trial. Apparently, they gave them some video that was backwards.
It just keeps trickling out. Video clips, evidence just keeps trickling out, just like pieces of the taillight kept coming day after day, week after week. They've done it. Yeah. And sometimes it happens, right? Sometimes it happens.
Right.
It doesn't make
sure.
But you're right. This is the pot calling the kettle black, saying 10 months. It's like they've waited years for certain evidence. They didn't even turn over certain evidence till the middle of trial or after trial. After the first trial, new evidence is still coming to the defense from the Commonwealth that the Commonwealth intends to use at trial. This is evidence they already had. The first trial is over. It's done. Any prejudice that happened in the first trial doesn't matter at this point for the Commonwealth. You have everything you need for trial number two with these ARCA experts. No doubt about it.
Right. So where's the ambush? And as I was saying, this is just, you know, they're just crying here because they don't like this. I mean, from what I read, these guys were really good. And from what I read, well, they shot glass out of a cannon to see how the glass.
They did
all sorts of cool stuff. And so, you know, they're just crying because these guys are so damaging to their case. They just don't know what to do. So they're just trying. I mean, I don't blame them for trying everything. But it's obvious that this is really an unsuccessful motion. It's going to be a waste of time.
No way. There's no way this gets granted. No way. All right. Now let's get to the defendant's motion to reconsider reciprocal discovery order. Now comes the defendant, Karen Reed, and respectfully moves this honorable court to reconsider its reciprocal discovery order regarding the defense pretrial production of impeachment evidence related to the Commonwealth's anticipated trial witnesses. As grounds for this motion, the defendant states that production of impeachment evidence prior to witness testimony is not required under Rule 14 and will unduly prejudice the defense by allowing witnesses to tailor their responses to preempt cross-examination. The production of impeachment evidence related to witnesses proffered by an adverse party is not subject to mandatory disclosure under Rule 14, and in this case would be particularly prejudicial to the defendant given the public nature of the proceedings and the close personal relationships of many of the parties involved. Factual background. Ms. Reed is accused of the following crimes arising out of the death of John O'Keefe: murder in the second degree, count one, manslaughter while under the influence of alcohol, count two, and leaving the scene of personal injury and death in violation of this law, this rule, count three. Ms. Reed faced a trial by jury for the above crimes beginning on April 16th, 2024. Prior to the commencement of the trial, the Commonwealth submitted a motion for reciprocal discovery and notice of any experts filed on March 21st, 2024. With this court, paragraph four of the Commonwealth's motion requested production of the defendant any written or recorded statement, as well as any oral statement reduced to writing of any individual whom the Commonwealth intends to call as a witness at trial, including but not limited to such statements contained in the defense investigator reports or other non-legal reports. The Commonwealth's motion was allowed by this court, requiring the defendant to turn over evidence intended to be used as impeachment evidence against witnesses called by the Commonwealth prior to those witnesses being called to testify at trial. By the way, that's normal. In most cases, you have to turn over impeachment evidence. It's part of discovery. Both sides get to get it. So it's not like that was some crazy ruling that happened in the first trial.
Well, it's not. It's not necessarily. I mean, it happens normally, but the rule doesn't necessarily require impeachment evidence to be turned over. Judges normally issue these are standard orders,
right. Exactly.
And judges normally issue these orders. It goes beyond the norm of the rule, but they do this in order to make sure the trial doesn't get delayed by a whole bunch of stuff being turned over during the middle of the trial. But it's not always required.
In federal court,
it's for sure not required.
Well, we're not talking about federal court. In state court, and especially in civil cases, you almost always have to turn it over. It's almost always in a standard request that we always ask. So we make sure we check that box. So if anything exists, it turns over. What's interesting about it, actually, I'm going to save some of the shenanigans that happen in impeachment evidence in some of our cases till we get later in the motion. On several occasions during various Commonwealth witnesses' testimony at trial, the witnesses subsequently tailored their testimony and included details which had not previously been discussed to account for the impeachment evidence turned over by the defense. So he's basically saying they changed their testimony or made sure they were not going to get impeached with the impeachment evidence that the defense turned over. For example, and he gives examples, which I love. At trial on May 21st, 2024, Jennifer McCabe testified for the prosecution. During cross-examination, Ms. McCabe testified that on January 30th, 2022, the day after John O'Keefe had been found in front of 34 Fairview Road, she went to the house of Canton Police Lieutenant Michael Lenk. Prior to this testimony, Ms. McCabe had never disclosed publicly or in any report or witness interview, even when asked directly about her meetings and conversations in the days and weeks following January 29th, that she visited the house of one of the responding officers to 34 Fairview Road, who is friendly with Mike Lenk and knew of him growing up, testified that she could have been at Lieutenant Lenk's house for an hour. After initially denying having entered Lieutenant Lenk's house during the hour that she was present, she then remarked how she might have ran in to go to the bathroom. When asked why she had never testified to this incident before, Ms. McCabe responded, "I guess I never thought much of it." The only time Ms. McCabe claimed to have discussed this meeting with anyone related to the case was at the DA's office with Mr. Lally, Ms. McLaughlin, Stephen Nelson, and Trooper Brian Tully. Ms. McCabe confirmed that at that meeting with the prosecution, she was specifically asked about her meeting at Lieutenant Lenk's home, something which she had never revealed and about which she had never previously been questioned. And just so I can set the stage for everybody listening, what the defense wanted to do was have McCabe on direct examination, go through her day, go through everything that happened, and not mention Lenk. And then they would get up on cross and say, "Well, we have this that proves you went to Lenk's house and you just lied to this jury because you didn't tell him you went there." But instead, she was able to vaguely say, I may have stopped by here. I may have gone inside to go to the bathroom, so that, that when they come with the hammer, it doesn't hit as hard, because she's already softened the blow by saying, yeah, I went there, but really inoculated it to make it seem like it was no big deal. Have you ever had this happen before in a trial where you think witnesses are tailoring their testimony based on impeachment evidence?
Oh, absolutely.
All the time.
And frankly, as a prosecutor, when I'm doing witness prep, when I'm going through the witnesses and preparing them to testify, if I have impeachment evidence, I'll tell them, well, what about this? And what about that? And did you do this? And did you do that? Because I have the cross-examination of the defense lawyer right there, and I'm going to prepare them for that cross-examination. So absolutely do I use the impeachment evidence to prep the witness.
And we use phrases like, we got to deal with this now. Like, this exists. We got to deal with this. Why didn't you tell us, explain this to us? And then whatever their explanation is what we have to use, right? Well, right. You know, if you fight for the truth and justice, it's like, okay, well, let's deal with it. And we'll deal with it on direct so we can lessen the blow. That's almost exactly what happens when you get impeachment evidence. So it's not that shocking that something like that would happen. And on cross, the defense did exactly what you can do. You never mentioned that until today, right? And you can pull out all the interviews. You got interviewed on this date. You got interviewed on this date by the cops. You got interviewed on this date. And you never mentioned it until today. Isn't that right? And it hits, but it doesn't hit it hard, as hard as if she didn't even mention it on direct examination. Right. So I understand the frustration.
And one of the rules, too, of this is you bring it out before the defense can bring it out. So you lessen the blow of it. And sometimes you even bring it out in your opening statement to the jury, telling the jury, okay, this and this and this is going to happen. And they're going to remember some things today that they hadn't remembered in the past. But, you know, that's the way people's memories work sometimes. So you prepare the jury for the fact that there's going to be some, you know, stuff, new stuff coming out that wasn't in the police report, so that by the time the defense lawyer cross-examined, the jury's kind of fallen asleep about it.
Yeah, and it just is not that big of a deal anymore.
Right.
At trial, she saved this information for cross-examination. After questioning Ms. McCabe about a different topic, Attorney Jackson asked Ms. McCabe, did anything significant happen on January 30th? Any get-togethers, anything you could think of? Ms. McCabe said, I went to the O'Keefe's house. Attorney Jackson followed up. Other than that, in response to this open-ended question, without any indication from Attorney Jackson regarding the answer he was seeking, Ms. McCabe volunteered this answer. On the way home, Carrie Roberts' daughter is good friends with Michael Lank, so we dropped her off at Michael Lank's house, and Mike's wife came out for a second, and him and Carrie are friends, and she, you know, jumped in the car and was consoling Carrie, asks how the O'Keefes were doing, and, you know, we talked to her. So again, she was definitely ready and prepped with this answer, probably from her preparation with the prosecutor about her testimony, because they knew what was coming with the impeachment evidence. This extremely detailed and comprehensive explanation as an answer to Attorney Jackson's open-ended question accompanied by Ms. McCabe's testimony that she had been asked about this meeting by Mr. Lally at the DA's office leads to the inescapable inference that Ms. McCabe was prepared for this impeachment question in advance of trial. Yeah, that's what always happens. That was only possible because, in compliance with the court's impeachment evidence reciprocal discovery order, the defense had turned over location data obtained from Ms. McCabe's cell phone to the prosecution on May 6, 2024. This location data showed that Ms. McCabe was indeed present at Lieutenant Lank's personal home for approximately 45 minutes on January 30th, 2022. Although the Commonwealth did not elicit this information during its direct examination, Ms. McCabe had clearly been prepared for the question on cross-examination as a result of the defendant's production of impeachment evidence. Another example occurred at trial on May 28, 2024, when PF testified, this is John O'Keefe's nephew / adopted son, for the prosecution. PF, who was 11 years old at the time of Mr. O'Keefe's death and 13 years old at the time of his testimony, described his experiences with the defendant. During a SAIN interview, on February 22nd, 2022, PF had testified about an incident where the defendant, that at least one witness likely violated the sequestration order with the knowledge of the prosecution. On July 1st, 24, the prosecution witness, Michael Proctor, sent a text message to ADA Lally, stated, yeah, didn't watch the asshole Jackson's closing for good reason. Like all of us, the anticipation and anxiety of the verdict has us all on edge. So again, Proctor sending more texts that they're going to use against him even post-trial, which is wild. Did you want to say something?
I want to ask a question about that. again, just for my education, because I know you kept track of this trial. Mm-hmm. Proctor, didn't he repeatedly make just, I guess, injudicious is the word I want to say, statements in his text to really jerky statements about people in his text that were used against him at trial. And yet, isn't he, and he's still doing it.
The worst probably I've ever seen. The worst I've ever seen.
And he didn't learn. You know, he did not learn his lesson. Because here he is doing it even after.
And the thing that's annoying about it too, or I mean, there's just so many parts that are annoying, but he's a cop. He's supposed to be a professional. He's supposed to be an administrator of justice, protecting public safety. And when he's on the stand, he presents kind of like that, right? He's like, I shouldn't have said that. They were regrettable. You don't like me very much, do you? Were types of questions he was asked on cross. He's like, I'm not too fond of you. But he was pretty calm. He wasn't a jerk about it. And then he goes and sends this text, which is how you know it's completely fake, that he actually is a jerk, that he actually does talk like this about everybody. And he just confirmed it even after. That's how you know it was a fake apology, basically. And my guess is, in round two in the trial, the defense is going to make it look like a fake apology with the text that happened post-trial and the fact that he may be completely fired and off the force by the time the trial comes because he has his admin hearing that keeps getting pushed back to make the final decision there. Mr. Proctor's message suggests that his decision not to watch the proceeding on July 1st, 2024 was not out of an effort to abide by the sequestration order, but was instead related to the nature of the defense closing argument itself. The message implies that Proctor had been following the trial online and simply skipped the defense closing argument because he does not like Attorney Jackson. So what I'll push back a little bit here is that is one explanation. The other explanation is maybe he didn't watch it because he knew he was going to get hammered and dragged through the mud, which he did and he deserved in Jackson's closing argument. I don't think that necessarily says he was watching the whole trial or violating the rule of sequestration.
I agree with you.
It could be, but I don't think the judge will necessarily read it like that.
And there's enough maybe there for the judge to make an inquiry, to ask the question, but it certainly is not conclusive that he was watching the trial from just that statement.
Even absent this admission, the unique nature of this case, including pervasive media coverage and real-time streaming of the in-court proceeding during trial, creates opportunity and temptation for witnesses to watch the testimony of others. In violation of the sequestration order, the risk of even inadvertent witness exposure to trial testimony, such that witnesses would alter their testimony or anticipate otherwise unexpected impeachment material, would be cured by the court modifying the reciprocal discovery order to exclude defense impeachment material. So there's a couple things here I want to talk about. Number one, if I was the prosecutor, I think the defense really wants cameras and likes the publicity and thinks it's really helping their case. So if I was the prosecutor, maybe I would follow this up with, Judge, why don't we just remove cameras for the second trial if the defense is really worried about this instead of, you know, putting other clamps on the witnesses, which I don't think the defense would be too happy about and I think they would fight with. But it's interesting. You got to be careful what you ask for here when the defense mentions the real-time streaming of in-court proceedings as potentially being problematic. That's point number one. But then I have point number two. Do you think, because I'm speaking at the FACDL, the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, this summer about how cameras in the courtroom are affecting these proceedings in criminal defense cases and high-profile cases, the live streaming. Do you think this does become a bigger issue that people need to think about when we're talking about the rule of sequestration, when we have real-time streaming of in-court proceedings where witnesses either are going to be called or are still under the rule after they're called? Do you think it's a bigger issue?
Well, I don't know if it creates a bigger issue. It makes it available when they're sitting at home, you know, to be able to watch it. When they're in the courthouse, you can kind of control where they are and where they're sitting and what they're hearing. So I guess really thinking about it, I guess because it makes it available, so easily available, that it probably is a bigger issue. It probably is something that I think courts, well, they do it to jurors. Jurors come back, courts regularly inquire those jurors, did you see anything on TV? Did you watch any social media, anything like that? I think it's going to become routine for them to ask witnesses the same thing.
You basically took the answer right out of my mouth. So I definitely think it's more of an issue because it's more available, right? But all of this stuff is always an issue. And what do? We rely on people telling the truth. We rely on good faith. So the way you remedy this is you just specifically ask every witness when they come down, did you watch any of this on YouTube? Did you watch any of the clips on Twitter or any social media? Did you watch it on the local news? Ask those questions, because if somebody's willing to lie straight to your face under oath, there's not really much you're going to be able to do to protect that testimony anyways. It's like if they're willing to lie to a judge's face straight like that, they're going to do whatever they want to do on the stand anyways, and it's going to create issues with the trial. That's number one. And we do it to jurors all the time, and we assume and expect and hope they are telling the truth. In the old days, the rule of sequestration, like you said, was easier because we could just keep them out of the courtroom. But the harder part was our witnesses talking to each other. Am I going on the stand? Am I going home and calling the guy that's coming next and saying, here's what the prosecutor asked me. Here's the cross-examination. And that would violate the rule. And again, we didn't know if that was happening. We would tell them not to. We would instruct them not to. And we would hope and pray that everybody abided by the rules. But that's how it was violated without us knowing. So there was always opportunities to get around the rule without lawyers knowing. Now it's just more available at people's fingertips. But I think you can solve this with the right questions at the beginning of every time, every witness statement. When they sit down, the judge asks them those questions under oath.
Well, I can tell you what, again, old days before a lot of social media, law enforcement was the biggest ones you worried about, because law enforcement, when they left the courtroom, they would talk to the other police officers. You'd see them all huddle in a corner, or they'd leave the courtroom, but you know, they would all go back to the station.
The case. We were talking about other stuff. We definitely weren't talking about the case. That's what they would always say, and there's no way to prove, you know, right, otherwise.
And they would, but I can tell you dozens of times I would complain about it. Oh, here's someone, and they come in and they never were talking about the case.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I never had a police officer ever admit that they talked about the case to another police officer after they left the courtroom. Never.
Exactly. And that's the point, is it's the same thing now. It's just more readily available. So we got to ask the same questions, and we got to still hope everybody's dealing in good faith and not committing perjury. Apparent violations of the sequestration order allowed, coupled with the defense production of impeachment material, allowed the prosecution witnesses to either preempt cross-examination topics by first addressing damaging information during direct examination in an effort to take the sting out of the cross-examination, or two, to have polished answers prepared when asked about the same topics for the first time during cross-examination. The inability for the defense to be able to properly confront prosecution witnesses with impeachment material without giving those witnesses the ability to devise a way to incorporate the material into their revised testimony created an undue prejudice to the defendant and improperly controverted the intended purpose of the mutual discovery rules contemplated by Rule 14. When the defense has impeachment material it intends to use at trial, the presumption should be that it is not discoverable before trial. Generally, a defendant need not reveal his defense. The defense does acknowledge that allowing the defendant to withhold evidence against a witness who is certain to be called to testify would undermine the discovery rules and allow attorneys to return to trial by ambush. Theatrics do not accord with our discovery process. That's really funny, right? It's like two cases that seem to be in opposition, which is going to come down to what I think is the end game of this motion and what I think is going to happen. But I'll save it until we're done. You have something to say?
Yeah. I read this, the paragraph for this Gionatzis, Giontzis case, because I just wanted to see if it says what he said it says. And it does talk about the fact that you don't have to disclose impeachment information. But the interesting thing was, it said that the defense lawyer improperly used the impeachment information and so basically kicked it out. But, it goes for the proposition he's talking about. But then it throws it out saying it was improper use of that impeachment information. So it hits both ways whenever they cite a rule like that.
I'm sure. It's not cut and dry is the point.
No,
the defense is not requesting to withhold impeachment evidence until the very moment that the evidence will be sprung upon the witness on the stand. Rather, in an effort to avoid impropriety rather than create it, the defense merely requests to withhold impeachment evidence until after the witness has testified on direct examination. By the way, that is when it's going to be sprung on the witness, which is during cross. It's like, we're not going to wait till it's sprung on the witness, just till after direct, right before we cross-examine them with that exact evidence. So that is pretty much sprung on them at the last minute, in my opinion.
And I don't want to be foolish, but let's face it, it is theatrics. It's a trial and it is theater. I mean, come on. The fact that you're that aha moment is part of the theatrics. And if the defense lawyer doesn't emphasize it to make sure the jury doesn't forget it, then he's not doing his job.
Exactly. such that the witness cannot unfairly preempt the confrontation. Once the witness testimony is recorded, the defense would produce the relevant impeachment evidence they intend to use upon cross-examination of the prosecution so they can adequately prepare for redirect examination. By the way, that would also cause trial delays, like you said. As a matter of procedural posture, as the court and parties are well aware, Ms. Reed is facing a retrial as a result of the initial trial of an initial mistrial. Nearly all or all of the civilian and law enforcement witnesses that will be called in this matter have already testified at least once, which in my opinion cuts against the defense. Under oath, either during the state grand jury proceeding, federal grand jury proceeding, or during the first trial. The only witnesses who appear to have not testified at this point will be a small number of experts who may yet be subject to voir dire. To the extent the defense sought to maintain any element of surprise, as the defense would suggest that Ms. Reed has been far more forthcoming than most criminal defendants prior to her first trial, much of that surprise has already been foiled. What the defense requests now, that the court not order the defense to produce impeachment material, will aid in balancing the need for reciprocal disclosure disclosure contemplated by Rule 14 with the need for remedial discovery measures to protect the defendant's right to a fair retrial. The preemption of impeachment materials by the prosecution witnesses is unfair because the record clearly demonstrates that the witnesses discussed above, including PF, Lieutenant Lank, Jennifer McCabe, and Mr. Proctor, either prepared for impeachment evidence prior to testifying and changed their testimony from earlier occasions or likely violated the sequestration order of this court. The defense is requesting that the court modify the order for reciprocal discovery only to the extent necessary to prevent prosecution witnesses from using pretrial production of impeachment evidence to tailor their responses as the interests of justice require. Whether the aforementioned violations are characterized as violations of the discovery order or the sequestration order, the court is empowered to impose sanctions ahead of Ms. Reed's retrial to remediate the threat of injustice under either scheme. Finally, the defense is not required is not requesting the court for permission to engage in trial by ambush, nor engage in theatrics. The effectiveness of cross-examination often depends on being able to surprise a witness, particularly an accusing witness, with evidence that contradicts or is inconsistent with his trial testimony. A second trial following state and federal grand juries and an extensive first trial can hardly be called trial by ambush. To the contrary, the amendments requested by the defense will permit the jury to assess for themselves the reliability of a witness's memory or whether an accuser is truthful. The defense is simply requesting a fair and equal opportunity for each party to confront adverse witnesses with impeachment evidence without each witness being able to review such material and alter their responses accordingly.
Just as a side note, I read Rule 14, the Massachusetts Discovery Rule.
Yeah, I've read it.
It does not require impeachment evidence to be turned over. So that's not... It's not required by their Rule 14.
So I want to get I'm going to ask you after I give my last kind of point I want to make on what you think is going to happen, what you think the decision is going to be here, and then I'll give mine after you give yours. But my thought I wanted to bring up earlier is if the defense loses this motion, one question is going to be, why did they file it in the first place? Why didn't they just surprise them with it? Well, if you bring up new undisclosed evidence at trial, even if it's impeachment evidence, and there is this order in place, the judge is likely to strike it as a discovery violation. So that's number one. Number two, because the order is already in place. Number two, I have seen lawyers deal with it this way. In our cases, sometimes if we have an expert witness that's been an expert a lot, what they'll do is they will give thousands of pages of prior depositions, prior reports, articles written by this expert, and just bury the impeachment evidence they actually want to use in thousands of pages of documents, because most people and most experts don't want to go read 100 of their old depositions and all of their old articles. So they may not know exactly what's going to be impeached. That's happened to us, and they can get buried under it, and a couple things can happen. The expert can either read it, and then guess who has to pay for it? We do, the party who hired the expert, because it's trial prep for them to read all of their own impeachment evidence. So that hurts the other side, number one. Sometimes you can do that. And number two, if they don't read it and something's buried in there and they don't find it, you can still have that surprise attack. If you give one text message, that's pretty obvious. But if you give 1,000 pages and that one text message is in there, then maybe they won't find it. And technically, it all could be impeachment evidence because it's all prior statements made by either a person, a law enforcement officer. They could give all the reports they have from a law enforcement officer. And it's like, you don't know which one they're going to use to actually have impeachment evidence on. So I've seen that happen to us. Sometimes it can be an effective tactic. Sometimes it can be unreasonable or unethical. I've never had a judge tell me it is because we've objected to it at times. Like, judge, they got to give us what they're going to use or else my client's going to literally have to spend $10,000 paying this expert to go review thousands of pages. And guess what? Most of the trial, they never use any of it. because there's nothing inconsistent, but they still turn it over because they want to be in compliance with the rule and the court's order to give over all impeachment evidence. So sometimes that's what happens, and maybe they'll do something like that if they lose this motion. So what do you think? What do you think the outcome of this motion is going to be?
I'll give you two answers. One, what I think it should be. I think the judge should grant it. I think the judge should grant it. I think the judge's original order might have been a little too broad, and I think the judge should grant it. And I'm just kind of wondering what the prosecution's argument is going to be against it, because they're going to have to say, well, judge, we want it so that we can prepare our witnesses. But in the history of this case, this judge has not been very good to the defense. And so I think it's going to get denied. But I see a good reason for it to be granted. He laid out a pretty good case for it to be granted.
Yeah, I mean, I think they make a good argument, but I do think that this happens in every case. Witnesses get prepared in every case. Again, you have to make sure the rule is in place. You have to make sure you're questioning the witnesses appropriately. What I will say is this is the exact motion that is up to judicial discretion. Different judges would decide this differently. And I don't really think there's an answer that, like, if she strikes the ARCA experts, throw her out. That's a joke. They're going to win on appeal. You can't make that decision. If she makes them turn over impeachment material, to me, half the judges would, half the judges wouldn't. So this one could go either way. Assuming, knowing Judge Cannone, I think she's going to deny the defense's motion and make them turn over impeachment evidence. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't really think this is one that is so obvious has to be determined either way. Like you said, I think it would be unusual for her to grant this motion, but I think the defense put together a good motion that if she does grant it, there you go. And they did a good job. And now they're going to have to wait until before cross-examination to get this impeachment material.
They have, but you know, they've got, again, this unusual case, as we've said so many times, but they've got an interesting argument because number one, they've got some specific examples, which I think are pretty clear, that the witness was prepared pursuant to the impeachment that was given. Number two, a lot of the witnesses have appeared before a grand jury. So they've testified before a grand jury and have been questioned. And I'm sure that it can be assumed that the grand jury, the assistant U.S. attorney, brought up all the negatives during the question. So they had that kind of preparation. They've had a first trial in this case, so they've had that kind of preparation and that kind of cross-examination. So there are some unusual things that, at least in the retrial, maybe impeachment evidence should be held back just to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's you saying it, but I don't think that's how the judge is going to see it. But that's all we got. Thanks for coming on, Dad. I appreciate it. It was a lot more fun to break these down with you than just to do them on my own again. So I like the little twist we added in here. And thank you to everybody listening and watching. Make sure you hit that like button. Make sure you comment. Make sure you give it 5 stars on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. But for now, that's all we got. Till next time, we're out of here. Dad, talk to you later. Love you. Goodbye.
Yeah, love you. Bye.
Thanks for watching another episode of The Lawyer You Know. If you enjoyed the episode, please hit the thumbs up and share with your friends who may be interested here on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out the Lawyer You Know podcast with new seasons dropping every quarter. If you have a case you want to talk to us about, if it's a personal injury case, wrongful death, catastrophic injury, car accident, or slip and fall case, please email us at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. And of course, all these links I just mentioned are included in the description below on this episode and every episode. So until next time, this is Peter Tragos, the Lawyer You Know.